This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and tonight we're off to the rodeo.
So you want to be a cowboy and you want a rodeo? Well, I don't see nothing to hold you back. Just pack your stuff and go. You'll travel many highways, and boy, you're gonna see it all. You'll have yourself some good times, but you're gonna take some falls.
So get your Wranglers on, your cowboy boots and spurs. Tonight we are going south and west to the roots of the American rodeo, to Prescott and Pecos, to San Antonio and Deadwood, for a rough and tumble tour of the rodeo world, of bull riding and barrel racing, of saddle broncs and calf roping. My guest tonight, W.K. Kip Stratton, grew up in Oklahoma, a rodeo-loving boy who lost his father to the lure of the circuit. His mother took him to his first rodeo in utero. Now he's dug into the circuit himself to lay out the origins and culture of the rodeo. It's part Old West and part up-to-the-minute TV spectacle, maybe the ultimate reality show, where men risk their lives for an 8-second miracle on the back of a 2,000-pound bull. Tonight on Point, Chasing the Rodeo with Kip Stratton. You can join the conversation. Have you seen it? Have you done it? Do you feel the magic? Do you see cheap thrills or Western majesty in the dust and fury of the rodeo? Join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK.
Well, there ain't no easy going on the rodeo trail. For every man that's made it, 100 men have failed. But if you're mighty lucky and you got a lot of try, there's a big gold buckle waiting at the end of the line.
Joining me now from Austin, Texas is W.K. Kip Stratton, author of Chasing the Rodeo, On Wild Rides and Big Dreams, Broken Hearts and Broken Bones, and One Man's Search for the West. That is a mouthful. Kip Stratton, thanks for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you, and what a wonderful account. You really take us into the life, into the athleticism and the sort of inside know-how of the rodeo. I said to one of my producers earlier today, I wonder if there's a rodeo on somewhere tonight. And in about 3 seconds on the internet, she gave me a list of an unbelievably long list of rodeos opening up on this very night in Mesquite and Reno and Steamboat Springs and Chino and Flagstaff and on and on and on. Rodeo seems to be alive and well, sir.
Oh, it is very much alive and well. It takes place in hundreds of communities, and there will be millions of people who will go to a rodeo or a professional bull riding event this year.
Kip Stratton, you clearly grew up with this very much in the blood. Your mom, a rodeo girl, her own words, I guess, when she was young. Your father, who was sort of swept off into that whole world, a rodeo, I'm not sure what to call it, rodeo bum. I mean no offense by that, but that's the phrase you use as well.
Yeah, he was a man out of Denver, grew up in the Depression under some pretty harsh circumstances there, and kind of found himself in rodeo. The problem was he wasn't very good at it. He's kind of built like I am, which is sort of tall and lean, but he wanted to be a bull rider, and that's really the worst kind of build to have to try that. You know, shorter, more compact guys are more successful at that. Mm. But he got it in his blood, and he couldn't get it out. And he spent a number of years following the rodeos around, and had a, you know, what we called an RCA card in those days. Today, a PRCA card, which is the top sanctioning body of rodeo. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he was never close to a champion, and never made any money at it. But he was just found himself in that sport and in the lifestyle.
I read your book, Chasing the Rodeo, as though you, at, I don't know, maybe 50-something or in that neck of the woods.
Not quite there yet.
Okay, I won't
still,
rush
still it. Holding at 49.
Okay, you hold on to that, my friend, like the strap on the bull,
right.
but it will buck you. You know that. It sounds as though you went looking for not only the rodeo today, but for your dad. But you came right back into the heart of the rodeo in that search to kind of figure out his life. What's your sense of the heart of the culture of rodeo? We want to talk with you plenty tonight about how it's done, because I found it really fascinating to get into some of the detail. But what drives the rodeo culture today? And is it the same thing that's always driven it?
Well, to a certain extent, yes. One thing is that it's a tangible link to the American West and the myth of the American West, if you will. And I remember when I was in college, I was very greatly influenced by a literary critic named Leslie Fiedler.
Mm-hmm.
And reading his books like Love and Death in the American Novel and Return of the Vanished American and so forth, I developed this notion that the Western myth was indeed our national myth. You hear computer programmers called computer cowboys or coding cowboys. You hear of Wall Street cowboys. This whole John Wayne image is, one of our great national heroes, and many people try to emulate that. And this whole thing about the West runs throughout our culture. With rodeo, you actually have this connection to the West. The guys who competed in the very first rodeos, these pay shows that took place in Arizona and Wyoming and Texas and places like that, many of them had actual experience on the cattle drives. And so
you're talking a century ago.
Yeah, yes, a century and more ago now.
Mm-hmm.
Many of these were real cowboys, as I say, the cowboys who drove cattle from South Texas to railheads in Kansas and Nebraska, then later as far as Montana. And so with rodeo, it is an entertainment event. It is a sport event. But there is this kind of connection. I think at one point I say it's sort of an apostolic connection. You know, if you compete against a cowboy who competed against a cowboy who competed against a cowboy
right.
who knew Buffalo Bill.
Right, the old originals. Right. And it just, the rodeo setting just absolutely breathes with that. Even today, my brother's down in Texas, and we've gone to see the rodeo down there with him. And, of course, everybody gets on there. They're kind of a peg leg blue jeans, and the big buckle is there, and the smell of sweat and livestock and the arena. And it can just take you right away. Junior Bonner was the big film back in 1972, Sam Peckinpah's film that captured it so wonderfully. One of my favorite films, really. But it's still
on. Extraordinary movie.
But it's a setting and a sport that's still very much in that vein today, tonight.
That's right. It's these small towns and, well, even cities. These become like fiestas in these towns. The rodeo runs for several performances. And in conjunction with that, there will be street dances and all sorts of other kinds of activities that really involve the whole town, just as it did back in the 1880s when a place like Prescott, Arizona, which is where Junior Bonner was set, first began its rodeo, which it claims is the world's oldest rodeo.
You've got the terrific story here of Freckles Brown, a legendary rodeo rider who you tracked down, finally sat in his living room with him, but you describe watching him ride this famous bull named Tornado. I wish you'd paint the setting and the picture and what happened on that famous night.
Well, this was in 1967, and I have to confess that I was around in 1967. I was 12 years old then.
Yep.
And we had gone from my hometown of Guthrie, Oklahoma, which is about 30 miles north of Oklahoma City, to Oklahoma City to watch the National Finals Rodeo in its opening performance that year. And it was a terrible night. Ice storm had blown in. A lot of the highways were closed. So it was took quite some doing for us to get there. And when we got there, the arena was, partially empty or maybe mostly empty because people simply couldn't get there. And many of the cowboys had a very difficult time getting to Oklahoma City to even compete.
The weather was just too bad.
Just too bad. But boy, am I ever glad my parents took me that night, because Freckles Brown, who was this, he'd been a world champion bull rider, but he wasn't, famous along the lines of some of his contemporaries like Jim Shoulders or Casey Tibbs.
Mm.
But he had, you know, he'd been a kind of a workman-like cowboy who had won his world championship, but he just kept at it and kept at it, and the years kept going by and kept going by, and suddenly it's 1967, and Freckles is 46 years old, and he draws the most famous bull in rodeo history up to that point, and in many ways still the most famous bull, a bull named Tornado.
Kit, before you put him on the back of Tornado, I just want to run through this list of injuries. You call rodeo the most physically destructive of sports, and then you describe Freckles Brown's injuries. They're just astounding. I'll never have time for all of them, but here's a partial list. Right leg broken 4 times. Left leg broken twice, left ankle once, right ankle twice, left foot smashed a couple of times, neck broken twice, a piece of tendon from his upper left leg tied to the tendon of his left ankle, severed tendon in his right arm had been retied, a metal screw in his left ankle, neck held in place by a plug made out of a piece of his hip bone, and on and on. An amazing toll that rodeo riding had taken on this man, Freckles Brown, and yet he was back to do it again on this famous bull. What would drive a man like that?
Well, there's sort of an addictive nature to this sport. There's another great bull rider named Donnie Gay, who many of your listeners may know as an announcer on some of the rodeos that are broadcast on TV and also some of the bull riding events. But Donnie Gay was a great bull rider himself, and he once said that he'd given up smoking and he'd given up drinking and a lot of other bad habits, but nothing he ever did was as difficult as hanging up his bull rope for the last time. There's a huge adrenaline rush that comes with this. Chris Shivers, a former world champion bull rider, once described it as standing on a railroad track and as a train's coming toward you and you step back just at the last moment. So it's really got a strong thing going for it.
It's a high. We've got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll have the story of Freckles Brown making his famous ride on Tornado. My guest tonight is W.K. Kip Stratton. He joins us from Austin, Texas. His new book is Chasing the Rodeo. You can join us. Have you seen it? Have you done it? Do you love it? Do you feel the magic? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
West of the Great Divide, I want to hear the coyotes howling while the sun sinks in the west. I want to be a cowboy sweetheart. That's the life that I love best.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Kip Stratton, author of the new book, Chasing the Rodeo. You can join the conversation. We're looking at the American rodeo, the life, the culture, the bucking bulls and broncs of the rodeo. You can join us. Does rodeo feel like history to you or like tonight's entertainment? And can you imagine taking that ride, all twists and fury, on the back of a 2,000-pound bull? Does it look thrilling to you? Does it look inhumane? How do you read it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's get just a little bit of the feel of the rodeo. Here's from Pro Rodeo Radio Network, a broadcast of the 2004 Wrangler National Finals. Here, saddle bronc rider Billy Ettbauer takes his winning 8-second ride.
There he calls for him. Horse rears out of there. He has him marked out. Oh, just about got rocked off, and now he's back in the middle of the saddle.
He's got
he's
it.
He's going to set the record.
Big old rear up.
Woo!
Big finish for Billy Ettbauer. 93 points. It's official. Billy Ettbauer's our man this year in the saddle bronc ride.
8 seconds, and it's finished. Big finish, saddle bronc rider Bill Ettbauer in the 2004 Wrangler National Finals. Now, Kip Stratton, was saddle bronc riding. That's different from the bull. We'll come to it, but I want to get through this story of Freckles Brown on the back of Tornado, if you would, because it's you tell it so intimately. It takes us into what it's all about to get on the back of a bull that big. Describe, you know, what it's like to ride a bull like that, how it's done, and how Freckles Brown did it that famous night.
Well, what had happened is Freckles drew that bull, and my mother was sitting next to me. I never will forget that. And it was kind of this gasp that went through the crowd when they heard that Freckles had drawn Tornado, a bull he'd never tried to ride before, by the way. It's interesting they'd missed each other so many times, but he'd studied this bull very carefully. And my mother leaned over to me and she said, "Oh, wouldn't it be something if old Freckles could ride that bull?"
Now, we should point out that the bulls in rodeo are come to be well known by reputation and by having been ridden by the rodeo riders. I mean, the bulls are on the circuit too.
Right, right. And at the national finals, you have the top stock. They rate the stock as they go through the rodeo season, and so you have the very best bulls, the very best horses at the national finals to compete with the very best cowboys.
You write that Tornado at this point was 11 years old, had been breaking bones and shattering egos at rodeos since the early 60s. This was 67. In fact, Tornado had made 220 cowboys bite arena dust before the 8-second whistle had sounded. That's a pretty triumphant record for a bull.
Oh, amazing record, and you got to think that some of these cowboys were legends, like Larry Mahan, many people would say the greatest rodeo cowboy of all time. I've talked to him on several occasions about Tornado, and he said that bull made him look foolish. And
a reputation so unmatched in the history of rodeo, you write, drawing Tornado made suicide look like an intelligent alternative. It sounds that way. So here comes Freckles with his billion broken bones and not a spring chicken. And he's paired with Tornado.
Right, and he gets on the bull. Tornado comes out of the chute with this tremendous leap, as he always did, and dipped his head down low, which just started this whole centrifugal force of spinning and all of these things that are just so impossible for me to fathom how someone can deal with all this. And the ride went on, and you had this sense watching it that... Well, Freckles is doing pretty good. You know, it's too bad he'll eventually get bucked, you know. and it kept going, and it kept going, and you felt this thing building in you. And you know, 8 seconds isn't very long, but while it's going on, it can seem like an eternity in the crowd. And I can imagine what it's like for the cowboys. And then, by golly, the whistle sounded, and you realized Freckles had done it. He'd pulled off the impossible. He'd ridden Tornado. And what happened that night after that, I've never forgotten. The crowd just went crazy. Everyone was on his or her feet. The applause went on and on. I saw a woman standing on a chair in her dress, shouting as loudly as she could. I never will forget seeing this guy with a crew cut haircut dancing a jig in an aisle. The people just
and tears streaming down the cheeks of people in the audience there, just to see.
That's right. That's right. And Freckles left the, you know, he took a bow and left the arena, and it didn't stop. It just went on and on. And the rodeo manager sent him back out again, and it started all over. And by the next day, it was a legend. It was already being passed word of mouth around Oklahoma City and soon throughout the rodeo world. And it was one of those deals where, you know, made politicians nervous in Oklahoma because Freckles could have run for governor and been elected probably.
You describe him pursuing the perfect ride the way a Zen master seeks Satori. And then on the other hand, the bull, Tornado, unrideable by reputation, but not rank. What does that word rank mean in rodeo talk?
Well, rank can mean several different things. Some people will call any unrideable bull rank, but there are bulls like a famous bull from more recent years named Bodacious, who was famous not only for bucking riders but trying to get after the riders once they were down on the ground and causing injury. Certainly, he injured Tough Hedeman in a very bad way that's a sort of rodeo legend in itself. But, you know, Tornado kind of, as Freckles told me, he would give you this tremendous ride. Then once you got off, he would just kind of follow whatever the rodeo clowns were directing him to do, and he would leave the arena.
So he wasn't there to gore or to hook the rider once he was off. That wasn't the instinct in this bull.
That's right. Freckles called Tornado an athlete, and he said that's what that bull was. He said he could tell as you were sitting on him that you could feel his back tense up, and he knew what was going to happen, and he knew what he was supposed to do as an athlete. And so Freckles just had utmost respect for that bull, and still, you know, when I met Freckles, it was 15 years after the ride, and he was still talking with just this utmost respect for this bull. And it was quite something to see. And I, you know, at the time I was 12 years old and I was going through that awkward age. I probably would confess to being more interested in the Doors at that point than in
Sergeant Pepper, Haight Ashbury. That whole world was unfolding.
That whole thing, and you know, getting ready to get into a real good bout of juvenile rebellion in the upcoming
right.
years.
Right.
But that rodeo just nothing's impressed me more. And as far as the images I remember, and just what an amazing event it was, and then subsequently meeting Freckles for some reporting I was doing. Really was a very moving thing for me as well.
Kip, you describe a lot of these events, calf roping, steer wrestling, barrel racing, some timed and some not. Like clearly, the bull riding is the one that seems to me to really draw you. I wish you'd take us in, kind of describe the whole thing, how it works, because almost everybody's seen that quick image of it, at least on television sometime. But there were details here that I really didn't understand. The way the bull is outfitted, first of all, when they're in the chute, waiting to go out into the arena, take us into that chute. What's going on there?
Well, you'll have several hands. Some of them will be actual rodeo cowboys who will be there, and then others will be just hands working behind the chute who will get the bull ready. And there's a device called a bull rope, which is actually a pretty complicated thing that gets wrapped under the chest of the bull, then back over the top, and then wrapped around the cowboy's riding hand.
This is what the cowboy hangs on to with one hand, and one hand only, of course.
Right. And then bull riding, what you actually are doing is tying yourself to the bull. Mm-hmm. And they pound that knot to tighten it up at the end. And there's several different variations on how they do that.
In other words, you're tying yourself by the single hand that's gripping that bull rope.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And if you touch the bull during the ride with your free hand, you're automatically disqualified.
Now, there's a cowbell hanging off that rope beneath. Why?
Yeah, the cowbell is there. You know, a lot of people think it's there to irritate the bull and help make it buck, which it may do some of that. But the main purpose of the cowbell is to pull the rope loose once the cowboy's knot is loosened. You know, at the end of the ride, the cowboy will pop that knot loose, or he'll get help from some of the pickup men or something
right.
like that to pop that knot loose, and then that pulls the rope down and free the bull.
Just so the weight of the bell will pull it off, so no one wants to go up to that bull and have to take that rope off. But there's another rope going on here, and this one explained a lot to me about why these enormous animals are in such a frenzy in the arena,
right.
And it's called the bucking strap or the flank strap. Describe that for us.
Yeah, it goes around the hindquarters underneath the bull, just in front of the hind legs. And this is an area of great controversy. Many people think that when that strap is tightened, it causes the bull, or in the case of bucking horses, the horse excruciating pain that makes it buck. The people within rodeo say it's really a training device that's used to help reinforce bucking, and they tighten it up. And I heard one guy say all it does is makes them a little itchy. And
a little itchy, but there's another line of criticism that says it's right across the bull's testicles, and it's tightened the way
right.
up.
That's right. And I never actually saw when I was there that any of those straps were actually put over testicles or anything, you know. But it was certainly down in the bull's groin area, if you will, and same with the horses. And so
it clearly drives them mad, and that's why they've got their hindquarters so high in the air. They're trying to buck off this rear strap. Is that right?
Right, right. They're trying to get loose of the strap. If you'll notice at a rodeo, you'll see the pickup men. These are the men on horses. And a lot of rodeos now have pickup women as well. And after the 8 seconds is up and the buzzer is sounded, they'll ride up to the horse or the bull. And one of the first things they'll try to do is pop that flank strap loose, because once that's off, and these animals are trained, and whether it's causing them a lot of pain or not, you know, as I said, it's disputed by different people, but it certainly is true that they're trained to know that when that strap is off, the bucking is over. They don't need to do that anymore. And so they pop that strap off while they try to get the cowboy off the bull or the horse.
Mm. You don't really get into this issue of cruelty in the text of the book, but in an author's note at the end, you're very explicit about it, and you acknowledge that there's a lot of criticism from animal rights groups about the rodeo. Mm-hmm. Even from a former speechwriter from President Bush, Matthew Scully has this book, Dominion Out, calls it gratuitous abuse of animals. How did and you write and report that scores, hundreds die every year in the rodeo. How do you end up looking at that sort of price that's paid by the animals for the thrill and the excitement of the riders?
Yeah, I mean, it's a troubling point anytime you have animals who are injured or die for the entertainment of human beings. You know, to a lesser extent, you could look at horse racing. There are, you know, dozens of horses destroyed every year.
They stumble, they're put down.
Mm-hmm. Right, and so what's the cost of this? I'm an animal lover. There's no question about it. And as I mentioned in the afterword, I think it's wonderful that we live in these times when the concern for animals is probably the peak it's ever been in the history of humanity. Mm. And as far as rodeo goes itself, there are animals who are injured and some that have to be destroyed. I saw that myself while I was out there. And, you know, it may be that we're reaching a point in society where that's unacceptable. I just, as far as my book, I didn't really think that was what I was writing about, but I thought I had to mention it, and I concluded that it's a little difficult to deal with that in terms of rodeo without considering the whole beef industry at large, because rodeo is an offshoot of the beef industry, and mm-hmm. we look at how animals are treated in the beef industry is pretty reprehensible in many cases. I think I mentioned that I never saw anything happen in a rodeo to an animal that was nearly as bad as what happens to them in a West Texas feedlot, which is a horrible environment if you've ever had a chance to mm-hmm. see something like that, where animals are abused in the pens and live in really bad conditions for days before they're then slaughtered.
So here's a very dramatic setting for that interaction of human and creature. But you point out that there's a whole universe of interactions that are not necessarily beautiful. This one certainly makes some very dramatic moments. I want to turn to our phones. Laurel's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Laurel. You're on the air. What do you think?
Well, for one thing, I'm enjoying the program very much because it brings back tremendous numbers of memories.
Are you a rodeo rider?
In one sense, yes. I'm now 74, but when I was a junior and senior in high school, my mother and I belonged to a saddle club in Spearfish, South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
the saddle club rode in the parade before the rodeo started, and then we would ride in the grand entries at the beginning, mm-hmm. the opening program of the rodeo itself.
Sure.
And we did that at the Black Hills Roundup in Belfour, South Dakota, and we did it at the Days of 76 in Deadwood, all my home stomping grounds.
And Laurel, what drew you to the rodeo? Was it the camaraderie? I mean, it's like a great fair in one sense. Everybody, you know, puts on their special kit and gets out there. Was it the men and or women on horseback? What did you like about it?
Oh, just to be on my horse and riding. You know, I grew up with horses. My mother loved horses. My daughter still loves horses. And so it's just an extension of loving to ride and then doing sort of formal type of riding when you're in the grand entry and stuff like mm-hmm. that.
Did you ever aspire to get actually into the rough riding itself, Laurel, or was that not your thing?
No, it was not my thing. I was a girl. I was in high school.
Yeah.
And no, rodeo stuff didn't appeal to me in the sense of wanting to be a part of it myself, except for around the edges.
But we can feel the great memories of just being there in the thick of it. Laurel, thanks for your call. Kip, what about women and men and their roles in rodeo? Clearly dominated by cowboys, but you write historically about some very prominent women, about one, I forget her name, was it Lucille?
Lucille Mulhall, yeah.
Killed a steer in the Chicago Coliseum in a show, I don't know, 100 years ago.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting, by the way, if I could get to Laurel's call for just
a
moment.
Yes.
You know, my mom and my dad were married in Belfour, South Dakota during the Black Hills Roundup, and Laurel is
close
about,
to home, Spearfish
yeah,
there.
Yeah, and she's about my parents' age, so she may have run into them back in those days.
There's
but,
a thought. Wow.
But it was kind of an interesting call to hear, but...
Yeah.
Lucille Mulhall was the daughter of Zach Mulhall, who had a Wild West show that was notable because it introduced a number of important Western performers, Will Rogers and Tom Mix among them. But the star was his Zach Mulhall's daughter, Lucille, who was a tremendous roper, a tremendous rider, and, you know, she did kill a steer in Chicago while at a roping event, and she was brought up on animal cruelty charges, and the case was dismissed because the judge said it wasn't possible for a lady to kill a steer, that, you know, an animal that large.
But the steer was dead.
Right. She was a favorite of Teddy Roosevelt's. He had a particular liking for her. She was a woman who was educated at Catholic convents. She could quote Virgil in Latin, and she could also kill and skin a wolf. She competed at early rodeos, often against men, and very often won them. And so she was a very fascinating lady, and also a woman that my grandmother knew pretty well.
Kip Stratton in Austin, Texas tonight. Please stand by. Kip's new book is Chasing the Rodeo. We're talking about the American rodeo, the life, the culture, the bucking bulls and broncs of the rodeo. You can join us. Was this the first reality show, the first Fear Factor? And did you want to run away and join the rodeo? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
May 3250 just takes a fall. Now I live through it, tell you about it all. I'm a rodeo, yo, yo, cowboy, bordering on the insane, get us up, y'all.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the American rodeo with WK Kip Stratton. He joins us from Austin, Texas tonight. He's a journalist and author. He's written for Sports Illustrated, GQ, the Dallas Morning News, and more. His new book is Chasing the Rodeo: On Wild Rides and Big Dreams, Broken Hearts and Broken Bones, and One Man's Search for the West. You can join us tonight. Do you see cheap thrills or Western majesty in the world of rodeo? Do we have some primal need to watch people risk their necks for fun? And how do you see this? Is it real courage? Is it crazy machismo? Is this the American bullfight? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kip Stratton, tell us about what's happened to rodeo in this age of big media and all the rest. Has it become like other kind of exotic sports, a big money event? What's the picture?
Well, absolutely, to some extent. A number of years ago, some bull riders broke off to form their own group called the Professional Bull Riders Tour. And these are events that just feature bull riding with a lot of laser lights and pyrotechnics and things like that. And
yeah. Like Disney on Ice, except different.
Right. A lot of loud music. And those events have really been quite successful. They've been televised on cable TV for a number of years. And in the last few years have been picked up by NBC. And some of those events have actually outdrawn NBA games, so it's opened bull riding up to a whole other world.
What kind of purses are there in the rodeo world these days? Do people make a living at it? Do they make a big living at it? Do they not?
Well, the like I mentioned, Chris Shivers earlier, I guess he won the PBR championship in 2003 when I was out on the road, and he received $1 million for that one final event, and that's just unheard of. A guy like Freckles Brown, he rodeoed for years and years, and I'm sure never came close to making $1 million total with all of his purses over the years.
It sounds like that's fairly unusual. You must have a lot of guys kind of living out of the back of a pickup truck doing this.
Well, you do. The top 15 riders, if we get back to the full rodeo, you know, horses and ropers and all of that, the top 15 in each event end up at the National Finals Rodeo, and they do quite well, I think. They live pretty comfortable lifestyles off their rodeo earnings, and plus there are a lot of commercial endorsements available to them now that weren't available earlier. But, you know, at a rodeo like Frontier Days in Cheyenne, where you have maybe 1,500 or 1,600 cowboys and cowgirls show up to compete. That's just the very top percentage of those who will be there who can actually make a living at it. There are a lot of people who have other jobs who have rodeo in their blood, and they just will go to these rodeos to have a chance to take a ride against the best in the world to see how they do, and then go back to their day job and
hope they're all in one piece. Right. Kip, stand by. I want to invite another caller in here. Branwyn is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Branwyn. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi. What do you know?
What do I? I'm sorry?
What do you know? Are you a rodeo rider?
Well, I wish I were. Unfortunately, I'm deathly allergic to horses, but my parents were both competitive healers and headers.
Healers and headers, what do you mean? What does that mean?
They come out and they have to basically rope the calf or steer or whatnot by the hind legs, get them down, and then tie them up.
So this is a kind of calf roping, is it, Kip?
Yeah.
It's team roping is what she's referring to.
Oh, team roping. Okay, yeah. And where did they do it, Branwyn?
Well, they did it in Wisconsin when they were very young, and I was not even a glimmer in an eye.
And what are the stories they tell you about that world and that life?
Well, the stories that they told that I wanted to comment on were that the horses really liked doing the work. And if the horses weren't enjoying it, they didn't use those horses for the events.
You had to find horses who liked to be out there in the midst of it, who sort of felt the thrill of it themselves.
Right, exactly. And I've noticed if you watch, like, the World Rodeo out in Las Vegas when that's on, some of those top horses, they got to keep them turned around away from the spears until it's absolutely time to go, because otherwise they're gone.
I love it, Branwyn. Thanks so much for your call. And that, Kip Stratton, I grew up with horses. I have a sense of what Branwyn means there. But do the rodeo riders, they must work their tails off to find a horse that really wants to do this with them.
That's true. They do. These horses that are good roping horses are very expensive. The bucking stock, which used to be, you know, years ago fairly cheap, is now very expensive. These bucking horses, top ones, will bring $25,000.
How do you identify a bucking horse? Is it random? Can you breed for bucking stock?
Yes, and in fact, they're doing that a lot now is breeding, especially the bulls. That's where a lot of big money is. In fact, I learned that Bernie Taupin, who is Elton John's songwriting partner, is an investor in some bull breeding operations for rodeo bulls.
Is this like pit bulls or something in the dog world? I mean, are there certain breeds or lines of bulls that are more, I don't know, aggressive or likely to buck?
Yeah, they're going to be crossbred. They want some Brahma bull in them. Mm-hmm. That gives them the big hump on the back,
right.
And that gives them some of the natural tendency to buck. And then they usually are crossbred with Herefords. And that seems to be the ideal cross for most of these bulls. You know, in the old days, you would have horses that couldn't be broken. You know, not all horses can be made into saddle horses or be made as to pull wagons and so forth. And so a lot of those horses ended up as bucking stock in rodeos because they had a natural tendency to do so. And it was actually quite a good thing for those horses because otherwise they would have ended up at a dog food factory because there was nothing they could have done with the horse otherwise.
I loved your description of the saddle bronc riding, something I didn't know here, that the cowboy coming out for saddle bronc riding. Of course, this is one of those horses that does not want to be ridden. The cowboy must first mark out his horse, and we heard this in a little radio clip up there, which is to get his heels up touching the animal's shoulders for that kind of classic yahoo posture on the horse. I didn't know that. That's required. That's just must be done as part of the saddle bronc ride.
That's right, and if you pay attention at rodeos to the disqualifications that occur, the most often one is when a cowboy misses his mark. That means he doesn't have his heels in the right position when that horse comes out of the chute. And it also puts you at the most vulnerable position to be bucked off, and that horse takes its biggest buck when it comes out of the chute.
And you've got to be basically just riding on your tailbone almost with your heels up that high.
Right, and that's very difficult. These top cowboys, you see them miss their marks quite frequently when those rides start. But then, you know, if you got a great saddle bronc rider and a great saddle bronc, what poetry you follows, you know, with this kind of ballet of the horse bucking and the cowboy responding to those bucks and maintaining his form, it's really an ancient thing that, you know, ancient in terms of America, mm-hmm. that brings forth these symbols that we see, like the Wyoming license plate still has this bucking bronc with a cowboy on it with his hand up in the air. And it's just a classic American thing to see.
A lot of glitter in it these days, but I loved your description from Leakey, Texas. And we've just got a minute here, but you say, talking about this, you know, sort of not in any big spotlight, people doing rodeo where it's not in the glare of television lights. You say it's not like Little League or municipal softball. Those are merely pastimes. You write, Kip, no one plays rodeo the way he or she might play a mere game. Rodeo is more serious than that.
Right. It's serious. It's part of a lifestyle. And when you go to a little town like that and you see these small rodeos, these people come out and they might make a purse big enough to buy them dinner if they're lucky, you know, and nothing more than that. It's pure love of what they're doing and a need to do it. And it was a remarkable thing to see that little rodeo where people back their pickups up to the arena stands and were sitting in lawn chairs in the back. And it was so far removed from the glitz of some of the bull riding events or the National Finals Rodeo, which, as you mentioned, they're much like Disney on Ice. They've become, in some ways, just like everything else. But you get back to these smaller things, it's a unique experience.
The real deal still there. Kip Stratton, it's a wonderful tour of a world most of us do not live in, and you share it very generously and have again tonight, and we thank you for that. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, just thank you so much for giving me the opportunity.
W.K. Kip Stratton, his new book is Chasing the Rodeo. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. This is On Point.
Amarillo, I'll be there. They took my saddle in Houston, broke my leg in Santa Fe, lost my wife and a girlfriend somewhere along the way. But I'll be looking for aid when they pull that gate, and I hope that judge
in a moment. I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to some of the sounds of this past week.
Guantanamo Bay is an international embarrassment to our nation, to our ideals, and it remains a festering threat to our security.
This country is not systematically abusing prisoners. We have no policy to do so, and it's wrong to suggest that, and it puts our soldiers at risk who are in this battle because we sent them there.
What we all agree on is that it is time for a public discussion of our goals and the future of our military involvement in Iraq. This resolution does no more than call on the President to set a plan and a date to begin reducing the number of troops we have in Iraq.
During the raid, Iraqi soldiers subdued two insurgents and rescued Mr. Wood and one Iraqi hostage. Colonel Muhammad quickly turned Mr. Wood over to U.S. and Australian authorities.
If these disclosures are true, and so far no one from the Bush administration has bothered to respond to our letters, they establish a prima facie case of going to war under false pretenses.
Her brain was profoundly atrophied. The brain weighed 615 grams, roughly half of the expected weight of a human brain.
So today is a day of disappointment, but there's still hope there, and it's in Dennis's favor, that appeal, and that's what we'll be pursuing.
We, the jury in the above entitled case, find the defendant not guilty of a lewd act upon a minor child as charged in count two of the indictment.
Having a good time at R to Be Good, second and third, and we are in the midst of an earthquake here in Southern California as Lady LeCain goes past the half-mile pole. By the way, folks, I want you to know I loved you all, and horse racing was my first love. Off to the far turn, we hope, Lady LeCain.
And there's a week. The Senate Judiciary Committee holds hearings on the future of the prison at Guantanamo Bay. Four House members, two Republicans, two Democrats, call for a timeline for the drawdown of U.S. troops from Iraq. Australian Douglas Wood, held hostage in Iraq for 47 days, is freed during a raid by Iraqi and American troops. Representative John Conyers holds a forum on the so-called Downing Street memos. Autopsy results conclude that Terry Schiavo's brain had atrophied to half normal size. Former Tyco CEO Dennis Kozlowski is found guilty of grand larceny. Michael Jackson is acquitted on all counts of child molestation. And four significant earthquakes hit California this week. There we heard Hollywood Park racetrack announcer Vic Stoffer. Jack Beattie, shaking and baking in the middle of the race in California and all over.
And all over. And two moments of bipartisan courage on the part of Republicans and what you'd expect on the part of Democrats. The week began with Jimmy Carter on the one hand and Mel Martinez, the Republican senator from Florida, on the other, calling for the closure of the Guantanamo prison camp, which is fast becoming the second most famous such institution after Andersonville in our history. And then later in the week, two very brave Republicans standing with two Democrats to begin to talk about debating and discussing withdrawing our troops from Iraq. Representative Walter Jones, Republican of North Carolina, said, if we didn't do this today, we may be here in 10 years. And Representative Jones tearfully described how this came to him. He went to the funeral of a soldier killed in Iraq, and he said he had to take a 72-mile ride back home. And he said, for all those miles, I thought of that kid. And why was he dying? And how many more need to die, must die? Can we, should we, mustn't we debate this now?
Of course, this is Representative Walter Jones, who famously wanted to change French fries into freedom fries. He was so upset about French opposition to the war. A very tangible kind of public chemistry change around the war this week, but not so clear that that's represented in the administration. I mean, George Bush is famously a stick-to-his-guns guy, and I don't know, have you seen a change in that posture of determination to see this through to the kind of conclusion that the White House first expected?
Well, on the Guantanamo front, no. And you have to ask why. You know, there are 520 people there. 61 of them are awaiting transfer home. Why are those people there? According to one of the lawyers at the Senate hearing this week, only about 12 of them have been implicated in anything even approaching terrorist activity. Why are we holding on to the others? Even if they were suspected terrorists, what information could they have now, 3.5 years later, that they haven't since divulged under what we know have been our harsh methods? You have to wonder if they are not being kept there essentially as a cover-up, to cover up the scope of the Guantanamo treatment. And let me read you about what that is. Dick Durbin was criticized on the Senate by other senators for invoking Nazi comparisons, and I do think that goes too far, but he was wrought up. And here's what he was wrought up about. He was reading from the FBI report on Guantanamo. I can't read it all because we have a mixed audience, young children. This is what the FBI man wrote about his visit there. He said, the thing I remember most is the oxygen tent, a cube-shaped drapery. A tube ran through it to a large oxygen tank behind it and to the right of the hospital bed. It was difficult to really see faces through the plastic because of the warps and ripples of the drape and the slight fog of moisture that clung to it after each multi-minute coughing attack. I hated that plastic sheet, hated it with a silent fury. Every American should hate it.
And what was this? What was going on in the oxygen tent?
Some people were being deprived of oxygen to make them talk.
That is one rough picture. Going to be tough to deal with. Donald Rumsfeld, of course, saying this week, we need this. We're in the middle of a war. We've got to have someplace to take these prisoners. But as you say, Jack, what about those who have been there and nothing's been found? Still there.
And all around the world, a Pakistani journalist wrote recently, even the illiterate people can sound it. Guantanamo.
Jack, that's something to think about this weekend. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Thank you.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.